each other's lectures before giving our own.
Well, I mean, it was very helpful to have yours. Wondering whether some version of what you did 2 weeks ago would be okay, because I thought the juxtaposition of those two texts was excellent, very very interesting, and you've got a title on that, which we could use. But I think it would be quite helpful because I want to push it a little bit to have the comparison of or reading of.
Yeah, right. Because we didn't have time for that here.
Because I think I know what I want to do with that.
Good.
Well, that's good, John Chase. Yeah. That's excellent. Good. Yeah. I'm supposed to have done that, but I forgot.
Good evening. Welcome to the fifth lecture in our series of lectures, a joint series between the Center for Christianity and Culture and the Center for Hindu Studies. I'm Frank Clooney, Academic Director at the Hindu Center, speaking also for Nick Wood, Director of the Center here, who is running right now. He's running here from a meeting and knew that he might be late. So he asked me to handle things with Henny. But I'm very grateful for all of you for coming back, and I think you can see that over the weeks we've developed a very rich conversation around the individual lectures, but also cutting across them and themes that come to the fore. And I would encourage you, when we come to the point of questions and discussion, if you can see links to previous lectures in the series, don't hesitate to raise questions that cut across the different events. But on that note, I'd just like to introduce very happily our distinguished speaker tonight, Dr. Father Michael Barnes from Heathrop College in London, a graduate of Cambridge University. Been teaching at Heathrop College for a number of years now, teaching a variety of materials related to Hinduism and Buddhism and the interface with Christian theology. He has also taught at the Gregorian University in Rome. He has a great range of practical experience. He's been director of the Westminster Interfaith Agency of the Archdiocese of the Diocese of Westminster. And at Heathrop College, he also directs the Center for Christianity and Dialogue. He lives in Southall, part of London that is one of the most diverse areas, I think, and is very actively involved in the community on the ground in terms of the interfaith relationships of all the different traditions, including the Christian and Hindu. And he's also published widely a number of many articles and a number of books related to the theme we'll be hearing tonight. I'll just list some of the books and then I'll stop talking. 1989, Religions in Conversation. 1991, God, East and West. Christian Discipleship in a Multi-Faith Society, 1999. Traces of the Other, Three Philosophers and Interfaith Dialogue in the year 2000. And in 2002, Cambridge University Press published his very well-received and very well-reviewed book, Theology and the Dialogue of Religions. So we're very lucky tonight to have a speaker who knows the traditions, who knows the theology and the history, and also has the practical experience in the city. So I'm happy to introduce Michael Barnes.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, and you're welcome. It's very good to be here, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to, I think, revisit some of the things which I have studied over the years, but which have been slightly on the back burner in recent years. Frank has drawn attention to the work that I do in West London. And a lot of that, although it's connected with dialogue immediately with Hindus and Sikhs, it's also at the moment dominated by the relations I have with the local Muslim communities, which is a bit more daunting because I am no Islamicist. So thank you very much for taking me back to what I began studying here all those years ago. I did my graduate studies here in Buddhism and some aspects of the Upanishads and the Vedas. And going back over this stuff, I'm beginning to realize some of the things which got me excited all those years ago. I met my my supervisor from those years a while back, and we were musing about what we'd done in the years between, and he said to me, "Michael, what is the more depressing?" He said, "Which is the more depressing, to realize how little you know, or to realize how much you did know but have since forgotten?" So I'm reminding myself of things I've forgotten. In the early years of 2000, the Indian theologian Stanley Samarta was diagnosed with inoperable cancer. He very quietly and confidently prepared himself to die. And the last book, which he wrote during those months, is a brief and very personal reflection on death. And what he tries to do is to relate the sufferings of Job to the sufferings of Jesus. In a personal aside, he speaks about the various friends of his who come and try to comfort him. And his response, like Job, is just to say, "I'm at peace. I have no desire to go on living any longer. When the time comes," he says, "I will be ready to slip back into the stream of life without a splash." Ready to slip back into the stream of life without a splash. Now, there's little in this little book which is explicitly engaging with Hinduism. But those final remarks witness, I think, to the profoundly Indian religious sensibility with which Samarta approached his task as a Christian theologian. Like so many Christian theological responses to Hinduism, he was much less concerned with the exact nature of what all too easily can be reified into an ism. He was more concerned with exploring some of the traces of God which he witnessed at first hand in the people around him, traces which, however much they differ in language and symbol, still manage to resonate with what Christians hold most dear. I've got special reason to remember Samarta with gratitude and some respect, because many years ago, when I was on sabbatical in India, I heard him preach in Bangalore, in the cathedral. I spoke with him after the service and was immediately given an invitation to come and talk with him further. So we sat one morning under the trees in United Theological College, UTC, and there, in the course of a few hours, we managed to solve the problems of the universe, as one does. At least, that was what it felt like. This was shortly before the publication of a book which gained some notoriety rather later, the collection edited by John Hick and Paul Nitter called The Myth of Christian Uniqueness. In what he said to me, Samarta was clearly rather unhappy about being drawn into the pluralist camp of theologians, with its heavy rhetoric of crossing the Rubicon of religious separateness. When the book came out and I was able to read his contribution, I remembered his rueful remarks to me. Titled The Cross and the Rainbow, it fits rather awkwardly, that article, within the frame of programmatic pluralism. Along with thinkers as different as Wilfred Campbell Smith and Jacques Dupuy, Samarta wants to acknowledge the theological significance of plurality. "Can it be," he says, "that plurality belongs to the very structure of reality? Can it be that it is the will of God that many religions should continue in the world?" He bases his argument for the theological significance of plurality not on Hick's arguments about the equality of all religions, but on the Hindu vision of the essential interrelatedness of all beings, and therefore of all beliefs, all religions, all sadhana. "This delicate balance of relationships," he says, "is fatally compromised by an understanding of religion which emphasizes the rational at the expense of mystical, aesthetic, and cultural dimensions. Doing Christian theology in multi-faith India is not a matter of crafting an apologetic response to some version of Hinduism, which is identified by analogy with fundamentally Christian concepts or principles. It is, in the first place, a matter of developing a sensitivity to the form in which truth is expressed in the Indian religious traditions. Knowledge of God, says Samarta, is not something to be discovered through the study of written texts. It is to be recovered through hearing. The holiness of words is intrinsic. If I understand Samarta, he's arguing for an account of mystery, satyasya satyam, which recognizes that the one cannot be expressed without taking equal account of the many, of difference and distinction. Or to put it in the sort of language which we've been using in this lecture series, it's not possible to speak of self without in some way relating self to the other. But how are we to bring self and other together without doing violence to one side or other of the relationship? And where, for Christians, is Christ in all this? 2 weeks ago, Frank Clooney reminded us that religious traditions construct total worlds in which persons of faith find rich spiritual possibilities for their lives. If we're not careful, he said, a hard and fast distinction is made between insiders and outsiders, us and them, the ones who live according to this tradition of faith and those who don't. In constructing the self through the complex process of formation within a living community of faith, boundaries and therefore otherness are defined. But the canons of belonging which identify a community of faith can all too easily entrench division and difference. Now, the issue is clear enough. People of faith have a responsibility not just to speak from the particularity of their own familiar language of faith, but also to enrich that language through reading other texts and learning from others' traditions. Samarta reminds us that the study of texts is not enough. In some way, the act of reading has to become theological. That is to say, it has to become an act of listening to the intrinsic holiness of words. Now, in sketching out that issue, which I think is what's behind this lecture series, what I want to try and consider are a very few examples of Christian theologians whose lives have been enriched by their contact with Hindus. And I'm going to begin where Frank left us 2 weeks ago, with the tradition of St. Ignatius and the spiritual exercises. A particular hero of mine, the Jesuit Roberto de Nobili, was one of the early Jesuit missionaries who were responsible for a new approach to Christian mission in the 17th century. He was born into an aristocratic family from Montepulciano in central Italy in 1577, and he arrived in India in 1605, where he spent most of his life living as a holy man in the city of Madurai. He quickly became fluent in Sanskrit and Tamil. He wrote learned treatises on the Christian faith, and he died worn out, nearly blind, in Mylapore, modern Chennai, in 1656. He cuts a decidedly romantic figure in many ways with his saffron robes and his sacred thread. And when our Jesuit community that Frank referred to, when we set this up in Multifaith Southall a few years ago, we decided that he was to be our patron. We would call the house after him. Not that any of us has quite gone as far as de Nobili. It didn't take us very long, however, to appreciate just how difficult and fraught is the business of what is called, in the jargon of Christian mission these days, inculturation, trying to bring the faith into a creative engagement with culture and religion. De Nobili, of course, was a pioneer, and that's the greatness of the man. He was starting something completely new. His predecessors made very little attempt to accommodate themselves to the culture of the people to whom they went, still less to read their religious texts. Nowadays, he's more likely to be patronized as an old-fashioned missionary with just a rather more subtle way of presenting his message. Or sometimes he may be accused of colluding with the injustice of a caste-based society. Now, he had no doubt about the supreme value of the gospel truth to which he was committed, nor did he lack confidence in the power of reasoned argument to make that truth plain to people who were prepared to engage in debate with him. His theology was Thomistic in its style and in its presentation. Faith is not opposed to reason, it enhances it, it builds on it. The two work together. The result is a wonderfully logical account of Christian faith, which seeks always to understand what is other and to integrate it into a richer account of the single mystery of God's self-revelation. It's arguable that De Nobili never took the sheer otherness of Hinduism seriously enough, that it was too easily slotted into what Christians would now call a fulfillment theology. But it would be anachronistic to think otherwise. De Nobili's legacy lies not in some grand synthesis of Hindu and Christian wisdom, but in the witness of a life which was prepared to venture beyond the borders of the familiar. One of the Latin apologias in which he defended his approach to the Roman authorities, the Narratio Fundamentorum, this lays down basic principles for preaching the gospel. And he begins with the person of the preacher himself. The basic premise is that people will only listen to one whose manner of life is worthy. De Nobili saw himself as the guru who came to teach the lost part of the spiritual law. For De Nobili's Thomism is itself formed around the spirituality of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, with its sacramental, contemplative vision of the grace of God forever at work transforming the world, a work in which human beings are asked to cooperate. It shouldn't be forgotten that he lived and worked, like Matteo Ricci in China before him, away from the center of colonial power, in a world which was very much defined by the other. His desire to distance himself from the political influence of the Portuguese was easily misinterpreted. In fact, he was only acting out of this intensely sacramental, contemplative vision. If he himself had received the truth of the gospel quite gratuitously, that was his fundamental belief, then the same would apply to the other. And that's got implications for the way in which the gospel is presented. It must be explained without violence and without unnecessarily violating social practices. For De Nobili to communicate with the sophisticated Brahmins of Madurai would take time and demand much painstaking intellectual effort at learning to understand their culture and their customs. He sought actively to witness to the gospel, but he also recognized the need for a certain passivity, what I would call a waiting within the world of the other. He was clearly a man of his time. As William Halbfass, this book called India and Europe, William Halbfass reminds us that these early Jesuit missionaries were dominated by the uncompromising desire to be understood. He was a typical missionary. His work betrays a willingness to wrestle not just with strange languages, but with a religious philosophy which suggested all sorts of links and continuities with the great Thomistic synthesis, the late
Renaissance positive theology of the Society of Jesus. So he thus needed not just to make himself understood, but also to understand himself, to understand and to learn, if only so that he could make the appropriate connections and explain himself clearly. It's not difficult to appreciate the enormity of this enterprise. Gathering material, let alone interpreting it correctly, in his lonely outpost, would have presented an extraordinary challenge. Even today, when vast hordes of information reside in the few clicks of a mouse, if Microsoft is working properly today, it's never easy to get a true sense of the broad cultural context within which religious practices and beliefs gain their proper meaning. Rather more than in De Nobili's time, we have learned to distinguish between what I would call religion as system of belief and religion as community of faith. Not that you can completely separate those two. What is found in the texts is more than an historical record. It's also the life-giving collective wisdom which sustains people in their faith. Thus, the common experience of interreligious dialogue, and I think we've all experienced something of this, the attempt to interpret what the other has just said, but which turns out all too quickly to be, you know, not quite right. You think you've understood, you feed back what you think you've understood, and you're always told, well, this isn't quite what we believe. I come up against that, all of us come up against it, and I find it in some ways strangely consoling. However much I, as an outsider, attempt to put myself in the shoes of the other in order to learn and to understand, as De Nobili tried to do, there's always more to be learned, a further dimension of this endless mystery to be discerned. And Sir Martha's words come back to me. Where De Nobili was convinced that knowledge of God could be discovered through study and the exercise of reason, we today, with our Hindu neighbours, temples around the corner, put, I think, probably greater weight on recovering it in the process of personal engagement, or to put it in explicitly Christian theological terms, on hearing the word of God spoken in the words of the other. What complicates matters, of course, is that the two cannot be separated. Texts form the practice of persons of faith in very complex ways. The principle, however, which I take from De Nobili is clear: a willingness to wait and to learn, to spend time in another religious world. His theological vision, too, remains valid for Christians today. The single mystery of God's action in the world, an action which is both creative and redemptive. And if that is correct, then Christian theologians have to be careful not to impose some arbitrary judgment about the extent and even the manner of God's self-revelation. Without such a presupposition, itself, of course, an act of faith, that the Word of God seeks to reveal itself through the traditions inscribed in ancient texts, dialogue does not begin. Self and other remain mutually exclusive poles. How have contemporary Christian theologians responded to this challenge? One of the more familiar names is the extraordinary Ramon Panikkar. Son of a Spanish Catholic mother and a Hindu father, sometime member of Opus Dei, Panikkar speaks of his religious experience in terms of leaving as a Christian, finding himself a Hindu, returning a Buddhist, without having ceased to be Christian. Allusive, eclectic, inconsistent, sometimes highly rhetorical and idiosyncratic, totally maddening character, Panikkar is nonetheless the most significant exponent of a theology which emerges from both a deep study of Hindu texts, most notably the Vedic tradition, and a highly creative interpersonal engagement with Hindus. In a recent article, the Jesuit theologian Michael Amalados speaks of Panikkar's global, or to use Panikkar's own term, his jargon, cosmotheandric vision. this rather cumbersome word is an attempt to bring the divine, the human, and the earthly together as the three irreducible dimensions which constitute the real, says Amaladas. Panikkar's idea, he goes on, is that the whole of reality is permeated with a triple dimension, material dimension, the dimension of consciousness, and a dimension of mystery. For Panikkar, we human beings have to find ourselves in the midst of this complex cosmotheandric mystery. We are part and parcel of it. The human person is neither, he says, monolithic oneness nor disconnected plurality. Identity depends neither on a purely personal choice nor on the unquestioning acceptance of authority. Rather, it's based on the fundamental dialogue which goes on between tradition, the community experience, and the more personal experience of faith, which is inseparable from that wider engagement with other faith traditions and cultures which make up our pluralist world. Rowan Williams, the wonderful article, very appreciative article on Panikkar, says that Panikkar's central conviction is that differences matter. Differences matter. This is a typically Williams aside, slightly difficult to get hold of. The variety of the world's forms, he says, as experienced by human minds, does not conceal an absolute oneness to which perceptible difference is completely irrelevant. I think that's a sentence which Panikkar himself would have been proud of. For Panikkar, it's a fairly simple point. For Panikkar, pluralism, or more particularly, more properly, plurality, is not a theory about reality. It's a fact of reality. It's a phenomenon which challenges rational analysis, forcing human beings to come to terms with their own personal and collective contingency. Panikkar's point, to oversimplify somewhat, is that there is something in the very process of attempting to articulate overarching theories of religious meaning which is itself open-ended. One of his more gnomic utterances is that, I love this, you cannot jump over your own shadow. In other words, I cannot stand outside the world of differences because I am myself part of that world. I can only begin with my own experience, my own tradition of faith, through which I encounter what is other. But the very nature of reality, permeated by difference and plurality, soon convinces me that there can be no account of self which does not seek to relate self to what is other, or to put it in another way, to understand self in relationship with other selves. Now, Panikkar's theology has been formed by his own very personal encounter with Hinduism. He makes explicit, I think, the presupposition implicit in De Nobili's generous vision of a world which is already filled with the signs and the seeds of the word. The question for a Christian theology in dialogue with Hinduism, indeed with any other religious tradition, is how it is possible to speak with integrity of the truth of God's self-revelation manifested, as Christians would believe, in Christ, while at the same time not occluding or totalizing the other. How to keep open that space for the other, which may well speak to me about the other, about God. And to address that question, it's worth briefly referring to one of Panikkar's best-known works, The Unknown Christ of Hinduism. Not because it elaborates a prescriptive theory of Hindu-Christian relations. It doesn't. And if you've followed what I've said so far, it can't. But because it illustrates something in the development of Panikkar's thinking, the way he's always seeking to work within his own tradition, which itself is being enriched by his constant engagement with other traditions. Now, the book exists in two editions, and there's a major shift of emphasis between them. The substantive part of the first edition, which appeared in 1964, originally it was a Roman doctoral thesis, it remains largely unchanged, but the introduction in the second edition is more nuanced. When it was first published, The book caused a major stir by proposing that there is a living presence of Christ in Hinduism. His grace is the leading, though hidden, force pushing it, Hinduism, towards its full disclosure. Now, at face value, this is a fairly unremarkable inclusivism, to use the jargon, a version of fulfillment theology. Christianity is not one religion among many, but the truth of religion. If it is characteristic, says Panikkar, of Hinduism to absorb any authentic religious truth, Christianity's claim is to embrace any true religious value. In the foreword to this first edition, however, Panikkar hints enigmatically at another book which he would like to write, one which he thinks Hindus would appreciate, The Unknown Christ of Christianity. The Unknown Christ of Christianity. This, he says, actually already exists, and the reader naturally assumes that he's talking about the Christian scriptures. And indeed, Panikkar does talk about the various ways in which God is manifested paradoxically as a hidden God in strands of Christian tradition. The language, however, is cryptic, or as Panikkar coyly puts it, polyvalent. In the second edition, 1981, he makes it clear that this book, The Unknown Christ of Christianity, consists of the Shruti, the Vedic and other Hindu revelations. Now that is an important clarification. It gives something of a clue to what Panikkar is driving at. The unknown Christ of Hinduism is revealed in the Bible. The unknown Christ of Christianity is revealed in the Hindu scriptures. The emphasis, he says, is on a subjective rather than an objective genitive, i.e. on the word unknown, not on the place where what is known or unknown is somehow revealed. In other words, in the second edition, Panikkar recognizes the ambiguity in the word unknown. He doesn't want to give the impression, he says, that somehow Christians know the secret and Hindus don't. This new edition, he hopes, will invite the reader to a contemplative insight into that mystery that can only be named in the vocative and whose name is a supername chiseled upon a white pebble that can be properly kept only in the cave of the heart of the world. I don't know how many times I've read that and still don't understand it, but anyway. His point is this. In some ways, Hindus already have that insight. The mystery which can only be named in the vocative by calling upon it. Interesting. The entire hypothesis of this book, he says, is that the power of the symbol may be so enlarged and deepened that each symbol, even if it is primarily and directly meaningful in the environment in which it originated, opens up experiences and realities not yet intended in the actual symbol. This point, he says, applies equally well to major Hindu as to Christian symbols. And here you've got somebody who, in many ways, is trying to lead both religious lives at the same time. Living symbols go on generating meaning. Panikkar, he says, he wants to avoid totalitarian exclusivism and libertarian equalitarianism, but he doesn't want just to adopt a via media of fulfillment inclusivism. It's not a question of the assimilation by Christianity or Christian symbols of the Hindu, still less a substitution of one set for another, but of what he calls a mutual fecundation, getting the two to enter into a dialogue and to talk to each other. Panikkar is saying that Christ, or, again, as he puts it slightly gnomically, the Christic principle always remains, in an important sense, a mystery to both Christians and Hindus. Both are searching for the meaning of that divine mystery which Christians name in faith as Christ. Why, in that case, he says, go on using the symbol Christ when something neutral might be more ironic or less threatening to the other? Such an objection, he says, really rather misses the point. Firstly, symbols are not created at will. Whether we like it or not, symbols carry the burden of history. But precisely because they are bound up with human memories, they also have a power for unlocking a capacity for creating new meaning. Christians will not want to hang on to the symbol out of some tenacious loyalty to an ancient tradition, but because they are convinced, he says, that Christ is still a living symbol for the totality of reality, human, divine, and cosmic. Most of the apparently more neutral symbols, such as God, Spirit, Truth, and the like, truncate reality and limit the center of life to a disincarnate principle, a non-historical epiphany, and often an abstraction. So, to summarize somewhat inadequately what I think is going on here, Panikkar's thesis is based on the conviction that there is in all human beings that which does not alienate, but allows them to reach fullness of being, as he puts it. It's not, however, a question of that reality having many names, but, he says, of being many names. Not a question of about how Christians can go on defending their name over against the names given by others, but of how together the name which Christians invoke can disclose to both parties what it has to say about the unnameable. Panikkar is only the most powerful example, I think, of an indigenous and genuinely Indian Christian theology. Many other examples which one could, if there was time, turn to. Protestants such as Paul Devanandan and M.M. Thomas, Catholics such as Jules Monchanin, Richard Desmet, Henri Lesseau, Swami Abhishektananda, have all produced work which brings the Hindu experience of Advaita and Bhakti into a close engagement with the Christian tradition. And this is only appropriate where classic texts, such as the Bhagavad Gita, are part of the common spiritual capital of the nation. However, much of this theology is now under suspicion, rejected as too dependent on high-caste Brahmanical Hinduism. The Indian church is largely low-caste. Why, it is now urged, is theology not done in response to the culture and language of the scheduled castes and tribal peoples, rather than that of the Brahmanical elite? The reasons for the emergence of what's usually referred to today as Dalit theology, theology done through the experience of the untouchable, low castes, these are really quite complex, these reasons. Partly, I think, it stems from reactions to political and economic shifts within wider Indian society. But there's also the growing realization that the church itself, supposedly an egalitarian and therefore casteless society, is in fact riddled with caste divisions. Now, the result that you get, so much Dalit theology, liberation theology, is a negative reading of much of the Hindu tradition. Instead of engaging with the wider world of Hinduism, reading the texts, a great deal of attention is paid to social analysis and the recounting of particular stories and incidents which illustrate the Dalits' sense of grievance. Their experience is often articulated in terms of polemic, setting Old Testament prophecy, the moral teaching and the actions of Jesus alongside Dalit experience to express the anger which, it's felt, represents the authentic voice of Christ in contemporary India. Now this is where the language of otherness can become part of the problem rather than its solution. What we have in much Dalit theology is what I would call oppositionalist thinking. Activists direct attention towards the destructive nature of the political forces which are inscribed in Indian culture and society, and dismiss interfaith dialogue as an irrelevant pastime for a few ashramites and academics. I met a young activist when I was last in India, when he realized that I was one of these people who was interested in interreligious dialogue, and he just looked at me and said, "Oh, but you are in peace and we are in pieces." It sounded like a slogan he'd used before. Well, the aim of Dalit theologians is to develop a sense of Dalit identity. Their problem is how to do so without substituting one ideology for another. Because protest and confrontation are subtly yet inextricably tied into and even determined by the structures which they oppose. A voice of caution, I've read recently, comes from Michael Amalados, who reminds theologians that the Brahmanical culture has been responsible for maintaining the coherence of Indian ways of thought. It cannot be ignored, let alone vilified, without damaging the complex and delicate spiritual ecology which is Hinduism. The risk is that Brahmanical Hinduism is simply set against, rather than in relationship with, Dalit, low-caste, popular religion. Now, how can Christian theologians respond to both ends of this really rather complex spectrum? One creative response comes from the Chennai-based Catholic theologian Felix Wilfrid. Wilfrid draws a distinction between the, as he calls it, the Eastern organic and the Western architectonic conceptions of reality, the organic and the architectonic. In the former, the various constituent parts are so interrelated that unity is not extraneous to the web of relationships. In the latter, the various parts are seen, as he says, as steps or stages leading to a preconceived unity. Quite an interesting distinction, the way he plays it out. The distinction reads, when you first come across it, and the way I was reading it at first, it seemed to me suspiciously like just another version of oppositional thinking. You know, in the West, they think like this. In the East, we think like that. His meaning becomes a little clearer when he turns to Gandhi as his exemplar of the organic mindset. Gandhi knew what he wanted. He knew what he wanted to achieve, but he refused to subordinate the means to the end. The intermediate stages were just as important to the pursuit of truth, doing things truthfully. Familiar to us from our knowledge of Gandhi. Goals follow from means, not because there is no clarity about the goal, but because for the Gandhian organic mindset, the goal is forever being reappropriated. With his sketch of an organic web of relationships in which all human beings are caught up, Wilfrid is looking for a properly Indian response to the obsession with the modern project of development and progress. It's one of the things he's concerned about. But he also wants to take seriously the reality of pluralism and the voice of the marginalized, the Dalit people. So what he comes up with towards the end of this book is what he calls the postmodern with teeth. The postmodern with teeth. not, he says, the reassertion of a conservative integralist theology of restoration. No, conservative postmodern theology follows a lot of that sort of agenda, but a centrifugal movement towards the other, towards what is different. The point he's trying to make is that critical resistance to the dominant tradition does not have to be couched in the blunt oppositional approach of much Dalit theology. His model is Gandhi, the archetypal survivor, for whom the present moment and the gathering of all things into a never-ending eternity, Wilfrid's phrase, is the only way of bringing oppositions into an ultimate harmony. Such a spirituality of the weak, again Wilfrid's phrase, is paradoxical, to be sure, and it's sometimes not easy to see how it's to be reconciled with resistance to injustice. What I take him to be commending, however, is the basic refusal, what he considers to represent the uniqueness of Indian culture, the basic refusal to set different options in opposition to one another. Instead, he points to the way in which so many mystics and the oppressed do not work against the culture, they work within it. They work within it. Now, there's something of this in both de Nobili's instinctive willingness to wait on the other from the position of weakness, and Panikkar's insistence that no one can extract themselves from the action. You can't jump over your own shadow. You're in the middle of it. Going back to Samartha's remark, de Nobili discovered the truth of Hinduism through reading the texts. Panikkar, more exactly, recovered it through hearing the word of God in his own cross-cultural experience. The question, to repeat, is about how anyone manages to recognize God in the middle, as I like to call it, the between of interfaith and interpersonal relations. Now, there's no easy answer to that. It's a constant process of discernment that goes on. So I'm just going to finish with one brief example of a Christian theologian who manages, I think, to avoid a simplistic oppositionalism, throwing out Brahmanical elite Hinduism, so-called, and sticking with Dalit low-caste religion. What this theologian does is to immerse himself in Dalit culture and manage to hear there something of the seeds and the signs of what Christians call the Word of God. My example is a priest of the Church of South India, a lecturer at UTC in Bangalore, Satyanathan Clark. His book, called Dalits and Christianity, is a study of the religious life of the pariah communities of Tamil Nadu. For Clark, Christian theology in India has to be both, he says, constructive and critical. It has to dialogue not just with the dominant culture, but listen to other voices to seek to understand how they use a variety of resources to make sense of their own social and cultural reality. Now, to some extent, the book does reflect the typical anti-Brahmanical rhetoric of so much Dalit theology. It's couched very much in that sort of mode. But when he comes to analyse pariah practice and their guiding religious symbols, it's notable how what he's describing is a community which has a certain distinctiveness, which is not purely derivative or dependent. At the heart of the practice of this community is the figure, the symbol of the drum, which accompanies ritual and which gathers people together. According to Clark, it functions both as an alternative to the caste Hindu text-based tradition and as a mirror image, as an alternative and as a mirror image. What's going on here? On the one hand, the drum enables the pariah to resist assimilation into the more dominant tradition by asserting their own particularity. On the other hand, it works within traditional forms by borrowing and weaving together existing religious resources into what Clark calls a jigsaw-like religious configuration. Resistance to domination by the other is set within an apparent compliance. Resistance is set within an apparent compliance. What this really rather fascinating and detailed analysis questions is the traditional opposition of the active caste Hindu and the passive Dalit. The latter, the Dalits, only appear passive. They maintain a relationship with the dominant culture by cultivating a sense of the provisional, which seems quite content to go on living in the middle, with all the dichotomies and the lack of system. At the very least, studies like Clark's illustrate Wilfrid's account of the Indian organic, or better, relational ideal, a tacit acceptance that no one institution, still less individual, is allowed to monopolize the sources of authority or cultural value. Now, this is primarily a work of Christian theology, so let me just finish with one or two remarks about what I think Clark is trying to do as a Christian theologian. He wants to expand the scope of Christian reflection on what Panikkar calls the Christic principle. What holds the community together? What enables them to negotiate the fine line between resistance and compliance is the organizing symbol of the drum. In a primarily oral culture, the beating of the drum does not just gather the people for what Clark calls, I'm afraid somewhat pompously, resistive and emancipatory communal affirmation. I think resistance would probably be enough. It puts people in touch with the primal sound which precedes the spoken and written sacred word. Perhaps in Catholic theological language, the drum could be said to manifest a sacramental function. It achieves what it symbolizes, strengthening a community of faith and mediating to them a sense of the divine. For the Christian theologian, the drum speaks of the Christ who, as the Logos, gives voice to the unspeakable silence that is God, and at the same time, through the death and the resurrection of Jesus, becomes the model of how people are to live with the ambiguity, the fundamental ambiguity, which is the lot of the Dalit, and at some level, of all Christians. This, however, is very far from being a Jesus who gives identity to the Dalit alone, who supports them in their struggle against the demonizing forces of wider society. Otherwise, you'd still be, you know, right back into the sort of now traditional Dalit theology. What Clark says is that the Jesus who's reflected in the symbol of the drum is an example of both resistance and reconciliation. Both resistance and reconciliation. You have to get on with the dominant lot, whether you like it or not. Jesus is the one who teaches people how to place themselves on the borderline, in between, where Dalit people have to learn to maintain that uneasy relationship with the other, the caste Hinduism, which in many ways always threatens to overwhelm or to assimilate them. Well, final remark. What's the book for? Is it more than an exercise in Christian inclusivism or fulfillment theology? In the introduction, Clark notes that there was a time when Dalit converts in South India were required to break the drum in public before entering the church for baptism. This was to demonstrate their complete rejection of the non-Christian divine. But such a hard and fast distinction is quite at variance with what Wilfrid calls the organic mindset of Indian religious sensibility. Clark's point is that the drum is a source of theological understanding, not because it can be neatly colonized into a Christian system, but because it points to the unfailing presence of God in the hearts of Dalit peoples. Long before texts are written, which articulate the sense of the divine, the word beats in the wordless rhythms which connect individuals with their communities and communities with the wider world and with God. It points to the interdependence of Panikkar's enigmatic cosmotheandric mystery in which we are all caught up. When Sarmata said he was ready to slip back into the stream of life without a splash, I suspect that that was what he had in mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. We have about 20 minutes for our usual conversation questions, so I think, Michael, you can probably take some field of yourself.
Is there an opinion about which I ask you your opinion? So it seemed to me that when Christians and Hindus speak about God, they differ. When Hindu and Christian speak through God, they agree. So maybe the eternal war is between theology and mysticism. And from this point of view, maybe this more ecumenical way to be a person of God, a man of God, was started by Francesco da Assisi. Francis, because in my mind at least, he denied three media. One, the media of the church in his relationship with God, because he speaks directly to God between without the media of a church, of a priest, also of the Pope in Vicenza Terzo, you know. Secondly, he denied official language of the theology, the Latin, is spoken Italian. And when you change language, you change symbology, you change imagery, you change the entire communicative code. And finally, he refused his caste, the Italian nobility. It was a caste, like the Indian one. So in this meaning, he was a different person who started, at least for me, a new way. A way that can conduce until person like the missionary of about which woman we have started your conversation. What is your opinion?
I'm sorry. What?
Your opinion, I beg your opinion.
Well, thank you for those observations. With a couple of thoughts. You talk about the distinction between theology and mysticism. I think that's a useful point to bear in mind, that at some level there is a distinction between the two. But I wouldn't want in any way to dichotomize the two. For me, theology has got to be something which grows out of whatever word you like to use, spirituality, mysticism, religious experience. But I don't think one should limit spirituality and religious practice in any way to some personal mystical experience. The personal mystical experience itself comes out of a religious tradition. And one of the points I'm always wanting to make is that in many ways, the personal religious experience which individuals have goes back to the liturgical experience of a community of faith and can't really be separated from that. Okay, so to make the distinction which you started with, I think is actually an important one, and one should always bear in mind that once you have got to the point of clarifying to some extent where you stand with regard to religious belief in interreligious dialogue, there is another stage which I think is, you know, probably the stage of silence and the moment of prayer, when you say to yourself, well, we're not going to resolve this one, but we have learnt something from this. And for me, it's important to take that back into not just my own personal prayer, but I would hope into the prayer of the church itself, my wider community of faith. I don't know how I can respond to what you're saying about Francis of Assisi, because I don't know very much about Francis of Assisi, but one of the things that does impress me about him is that in his original rule for the brothers, and he was thinking particularly of dialogue with Muslims, he did distinguish between what it was possible to say and what you had to do when it was not possible to say anything. And in some ways, I feel that what needs to be retrieved from Francis is precisely that sense that it is the context of living contact with people which may at some stage call forth the conversation, which can take the dialogue a little bit further. But if you don't actually develop that interpersonal ease of contact with other persons, you know, everything else, well, that's not going to happen. I wasn't commending any particular program. I was simply describing what I think is going on, and I was taking two or three examples. But I'm very conscious that in Indian theology generally, and Frank can correct me on this, there's been quite a marked shift away from an engagement with the great Sanskritic traditions, okay, towards a much more activist engagement with the Dalit phenomenon. Okay, as I said, this is a complex issue. When you bring in the whole question of conversion, Yeah, that I think is a dimension which, you know, just simply has to be borne in mind when you. I'm obviously not involved in this, so I'm only, you know, watching it from you know, one step removed, as it were. But I do think, and it's something I develop in my book on this, that there is an ethical question, not so much a political question, an ethical question about how you go about engaging in interreligious dialogue. And it does raise questions, okay, for me, about how a particular approach, what I call oppositionalism, okay, sets, if you're not careful, one group against another. It contributes to the fragmentation of a caste-based society rather than, you know, working to overcome it. But I'm not in touch. I was a few years ago, but I'm simply not in touch with what's going on in India at the moment. I have my own theories about the conversion issue, and I think it's probably got more to do with education than anything else, but that's another matter. If I could just say something about my own experience in this country, I don't engage in a great deal of Christian-Hindu dialogue, simply because in Southall we're dominated by Sikhs, and simply in terms of time, I spend more time with Buddhists, where I'm specialised, and Muslims, simply because that's the real crying need. But I am conscious that whenever we have a talk in which a Sikh, sometimes, or a Hindu is involved, okay, the whole, and there are people there who are Dalit or low caste, and there's quite a number of them around Southall, you realise this caste issue, you know, bubbles to the surface very, very quickly. And there isn't so much a complaint against me. Why are you involved in dialogue with the caste lot? But it somehow, you know, simmers below the surface, and sometimes it does bubble through. How to cope with that on a personal level? Well, I still try and keep my head down. But seriously, I think what I'm always trying to draw attention to is that there is, a sort of pathology of inter-caste relations which one has to face up to. And it's here in this country. Obviously, it's been exported wherever you know, Indian communities settle. And it's there in Catholic communities. It's there in all religious communities. And yet, it always seems to me that there is an ideal which it represents of a particular type of social system. And you cannot simply dismiss the whole thing. And I go back to Michael Amaladas's comment, you know, we have to be very careful here about interfering and appearing to vilify a structure, a very complex structure, in which a tradition has been maintained and at its best goes on being maintained. Frank, I don't know whether you have any comment on that, because I know the couple of talks you've given to me, that question has come up, hasn't it? You talk specifically about the text-based tradition, and you get comments coming back, what about the Dalits? How do you handle it?
Keep my head down.
Yeah.
Two things I usually say in that tradition is that I think the interconnection between religious traditions is a community activity, not the work of an individual.
Yeah.
And that no particular individual should be held to the goal of you should do all of it, or you should do the most important part of it, but we should be doing all of this. And then secondly, I often point out too that I think if I was living in India permanently, or if I was an Indian Jesuit, I might do something entirely different from what I do now. But I'm an American Jesuit living in Boston, and there's a way in which the text is a great translator of cultures and worlds. And I think that can be justified and done without saying, I'm studying the Brahmins because the Brahmins are better than the Dalits. Yeah. But rather, the Brahmins actually write better books than Dalits have written traditionally, because there's a different oral thing with the oral and written culture.
Thank you. Yeah. Any other?
I'd like to bring back the problem of religious engagement, and you, according to the examples of the novelist and Panikkar, the idea of engaging by means of textual exegesis, which means basically to go about reading Revelation, which is not our own, in the case of Christians, for example, and by person. Now, in the case of reading Indian scriptures, there's often something that's omitted, which is there's a whole notion of adhikari, you know, as far as like coming to reading a text, carrying out exegetical study of text requires certain capacity, recognized within the tradition, but often not considered when someone approached that, you know, from a Christian background or any other background. So I was wondering if you considered that that aspect of the problem.
No, I'm not sufficiently involved in the exegesis of Hindu texts. I mean, I can read them in translation as well as anybody. When I was here, I read, you know, copious amounts of the Vedas and the Upanishads and some of the commentaries in the Sanskrit. I'm not sure that I could do it now because I'm simply not sufficiently in touch with that. But go on, yeah.
That shocked me because in the view of Panikkar, really, I mean, I forgot if I wrote that, but really, he was perceiving the true, really, the truth or the true, perhaps, face of Hindu text as being Christ.
Yes.
Right. So in order to see that, you know, you really have to see through text, right? Beyond the text.
Yes.
That, I mean, again, going back to the Indian text, you would have to really have the certain qualities. Not only have qualities, but you can't really do it on your own. To do this investigation would require, first of all, to have a teacher. Mm. The teacher would have to have also certain qualities. So to approach this kind of problem by means of exegesis is not simply, you know, opening the books and, okay, I've got some Sanskrit skills, let me try to do a translation. You know, it really encompasses lots and lots of
But I think my opening remarks from Samartha were meant to draw that distinction. You don't engage with Hinduism by reading Sanskrit texts. I mean, that for me was the big revelation of moving from a place like Oxford University to Southall or wherever it was, and finding out that, okay, although the characters in these temples, the priests knew the Sanskrit texts and they could comment on them. It was wonderful actually to hear the Sanskrit actually being chanted. I thought, my goodness me, I know that, you know. But it was a religious act, you know. So for me to read the texts is one thing, but I have to be in touch with the community of faith which is responsible for the interpretation of those texts. And you know as well as I do that, you know, the ancient texts come alive through the commentarial tradition. And I think what Panikkar is doing, he's saying, well, I'm part of that because I'm an Indian. Okay, I'm part of that tradition of commentary, and what I'm doing as a Christian theologian is adding a further layer to the commentarial tradition. But he's not doing it by sitting... Well, I suppose he is by sitting in his flat on the Ganges in Varanasi. But I think, you know, something like Panikkar would have been part of a living tradition, and he would have studied with pundits in the university and whatever, and beyond. And it comes back to the opening point you were making, that the only way in which the study of texts actually comes alive is when, as you say, you begin to pierce through the texts to take away something of the inner meaning of it, which may not be what the Hindu pundits say is the inner meaning, but it's what I, as a Christian theologian, begin to perceive of it. And I take it back to my own community of faith, and it, I hope, comes alive there. I mean, the only way I can do it, and I do it very badly, is by little bits of writing that I do. Every now and then you get some little insight as to what this meaning of this text is. But the basic point I think you have got to bear in mind, and this is where I think De Nobili is so profoundly right, is a sense that there is a meaning to be discerned in the text. If you don't take that as the basic presupposition, okay, that there is something here which is going to speak to me because this is an ancient wisdom which I cannot neglect, then you can begin to see something, you can dissect something of it. But you cannot do it on your own. I mean, that's...
Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, sure. Or comment, or word of disapproval.
I was interested in your comment, what I understood from what you said, that it's possible in encountering the human other to encounter the divine other.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could speak a bit more about that.
Well, it would take a long time to try and dissect that one. I think the point I'm always making is that it's not so much that you can see in the other, as it were, in the face of the other, in the person of the other, some sort of image of the divine. I think intellectually, as a Christian, I can, to the extent that I want to say, of every human being, that person is made in the image and likeness of God. Okay, and the line that all human beings share that common humanity and we ought to be able to recognize each other at that level, that obviously is the case. But I want to say something a little bit more than that. To me, God is revealed, and this is the sort of Buberian idea that I play about with, in the between. It's in the engagement, it's in the interaction, it's in the conversation. And it may well be in the silence, which, you know, follows from the engagement, where that sense that you know, we've encountered something here is most palpable. And again, the study, the engagement, the conversation is all part of the same process of uncovering something of the traces of God in the middle of all this. But that's about... You know, in a sentence or two is about as far as I can take you. Read my book. Yes, I didn't.
Just before closing, I'd just like to remind you that next week is the last week in this 6-week series, and it's coming by. And it's something entirely different once again. Dr. Savita Vij from the Oxford Center itself will be speaking on Hindus and Hinduism in contemporary Britain. That should open a whole different kind of conversation, but hopefully with some continuity. And let us close by thanking our speaker.
Thank you. Yeah, you'd be very welcome. Need to take this off. There. You probably know how to dismantle it better than I.